Ladies and gentlemen. Let us begin. I remind you again that next week we will, as part of our class, also celebrate Hanukkah. We will light the Hanukkiah. We will have our traditional party.
The challah's already arrived.
It's already arrived. Well, I hope it lasts until next week.
It's
all a good sign. All a good sign. Now, just a few words on the subject we have been discussing. Oh, even before that, Jake and Taylor, last week of the service, after the service of the Kiddush, I wanted to announce the radio program last week, because I had on the radio program last week Chaim David, the singer. So any of you who are the fans of Chaim David, I think they're going to play that again this week. I told them to do it again, because I couldn't make it this week. So I said, do the whole program again. It was basically a Hanukkah program, even though it was sort of prospective. Essentially, it was about Hanukkah. So it's a lot of fun. Now, we've been discussing the subject of money and the importance of having a stable currency. And we spent much of our last session discussing that subject. I was pleasantly surprised, but the way these things go, I'm almost no longer surprised, that of course came the Wall Street Journal on Saturday, and it was exactly the subject that we were addressing last week. So in case you wondered whether we were wandering off into subjects that might be irrelevant, all I can tell you is that this, which was the first page of the weekend journal, was 100% on point. The article is by a fellow named James Grant, editor of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, author most recently of Mr. Market Miscalculates. And the article is entitled Requiem for the Dollar. And I want to read to you a little bit of the article, simply because it so much reflects the issues that we were dealing with in our last class. Ben S. Bernanke doesn't know how lucky he is. Tongue lashings from Bernie Sanders, the populist senator from Vermont, are one thing. The hangman's noose is another. Section 19 of this country's founding monetary legislation, the Coinage Act of 1792, prescribed the death penalty. Oh, you brought it in too. Okay. You read it, so you saw. This was not exactly what you were saying.
I didn't necessarily get a chance to say whether I agree with that.
Oh, okay. We'll get to it. Section 19 of this country's founding monetary legislation, the Coinage Act of 1792, prescribed the death penalty for any official who fraudulently debased the people's money. Okay? Talking about ona'a. This is ona'a in sla'im. In the Coinage Act of 1792, the penalty for that was death. Was the massive printing of dollar bills to lift Wall Street and the rest of us, too, off the rocks last year a kind of fraud? If the U.S. Senate so determines, it may send Mr. Bernanke back home to Princeton. Not even Ron Paul, the Texas Republican sponsor of a bill to subject the Fed to periodic congressional audits, is calling for the Federal Reserve Chairman's head. I wonder, though, just how far we have come in the past 200-odd years. To give modernity its due, the dollar has cut a swath in the world. There's no greater success story in the long history of money than the common greenback, of no intrinsic value, collateralized by nothing. It passes from hand to hand to trusting hand the world over. More than half of the 923 billions worth of currency in circulation is in the possession of foreigners. In ancient times, the solidus circulated foreign-wide, but it was a tangible thing, a gold coin struck by the Byzantine Empire. Between Waterloo and the Great Depression, the pound sterling ruled the roost, but it was convertible into gold. Slip your banknotes through a teller's window and the Bank of England would return the appropriate number of gold sovereigns. The dollar is faith-based. There's nothing behind it but Congress. But now the world is losing faith as well it might. It's not that the dollar is overvalued. Economists at Deutsche Bank estimates it's 20% too cheap against the euro. The problem lies with its management. The greenback is a glorious old brand that's looking more and more like General Motors. You get the strong impression that Mr. Bernanke fails to appreciate the tenuousness of the situation, fails to understand that the pure paper dollar is a contrivance only 38 years old, brand new, really, and that the experiment may yet come to naught. That is his approach here, that the way in which we're functioning with a currency which is the result of convention, and people just having a certain amount of faith in it, is very recent and probably is going to go the way of other such things. Indeed, history and mathematics agree that it will certainly come to naught. I mean, that's a rather strong statement. Paper currencies are wasting assets. In time, they lose all their value. Persistent inflation at even seemingly triflingly amounts adds up over the course of half a century. Before you know it, the bill in your wallet won't buy a pack of gum. For most of this country's history, the dollar was exchangeable into gold or silver. Sound money was the kind that rang when you dropped it. We said something was a sound investment. That comes from the idea that there was hard currency behind it. It would make a sound if you dropped it. For a long time, the rate of exchange was an ounce of gold for $20.67. Following the Roosevelt devaluation of 1933, the rate of exchange became an ounce of gold for $35. After 1933, only foreign governments and central banks were privileged to swap unwanted paper for gold, and most of these official institutions refrained from asking after 1946, it seemed by the late 1960s, however, some of these overseas dollar holders, notably France, began to clamor for gold. They were well advised to do so, dollars being in demonstrable surplus. President Richard Nixon solved that problem in August 1971 by suspending convertibility altogether. From that day to this, in the words of John Exter's City Banker and Monetary Critic, a Federal Reserve note has been an I owe you nothing. To understand the scrape we are in, it may help a little to understand the system we left behind. A proper gold standard was a well-oiled machine. The metal actually moved, and so moving, checked what are politely known today as imbalances. Say a certain baseball-loving North American country were running a persistent trade deficit. Under the monetary system we don't have, and which only a few are yet even talking about instituting, the deficit country would remit to its creditors not pieces of easily duplicable paper, but scarce gold bars. Gold was money, is in fact still money, and the loss would set in train a series of painful but necessary adjustments in the country that had been watching baseball instead of making things to sell. That's his attack here. Interest rates would rise in that deficit country. Its prices would fall, its credit would be curtailed, its exports would increase, and its imports decrease. At length, the deficit country would be restored to something like competitive trim. The gold would come sailing back to where it started. As it is today, dollars are piled higher and higher in the vaults of America's Asian creditors. There's no adjustment mechanism, only recriminations. And the first suggestion that, from the creditor's point of view, enough is enough. So he goes on, and the rest of this article is all about, obviously, as a fellow who believes in the gold standard, and that we've left that for a type of monetary system that is really not very good, number one, and number two, it's not going to last, and we will suffer as a result of that. Now, I have, of course, in no position to have any opinion on this subject. It's not exactly a Talmudist area of expertise. My sole interest in bringing it to your attention is that, more or less, this is precisely the interest of the Talmud. The Talmud is interested in a stable currency, the importance of stable currencies in commercial transactions, and in order to create that, to stabilize it, one of the things that we are concerned about is the notion of fraud. It's not real fraud, but it is the possibility that the currency itself won't represent what it's supposed to be representing. And that notion is a notion that we've really forgotten since after President Nixon got us off the standard where there was an equivalency between our currency and the notion of some hard substance behind it. We've been living in a different reality, and therefore these issues, I think, are very distant from us. Whether there is any truth to what he says, we'll be interested to find out. Probably won't know that for a really long time, and I hope that my time will have been passed by the time that comes. So I would like to see my dollars be worthy only of bubble gum. So that wouldn't be a good end to this.
Don't they mention silver?
Yes, he mentioned silver. He mentioned silver, but he's really most concerned about gold.
James Grant has been writes the Grant Interest Rate, and it is probably most influential biweekly in the financial marketplace. It costs $25,000 to subscribe. I get a complimentary edition from either buddy. So it's very kind. He doesn't have many compliments, and if you repeat this, he'll kill me. But anyway, so I read it. I've been reading it for years. James Grant has proposed that we should be on the gold standard ever since I started reading it, and I don't think he started when I started reading it. So you just get that despite economic ups and downs, he still believes that money should have a hard value, a collateralized value.
Exactly.
And he now has been given birth in the Wall Street Journal, so they now publish his essays at least once a month.
I see.
And he does two conferences a year. His conference is in spring. It's already sold out.
Very interesting.
And he has other speakers besides him, but it's already sold out. Mm-hmm. I think it costs a couple of $1,000s for, you know, a half-day program. So it's been very interesting for someone like me to observe that he is being given a opportunity for a platform way beyond what had been his, you know, much, much more group. He was sort of the in crowd in the financial world. And it's the Wall Street Journal, obviously. It's Murdoch who like this argument. So you do need to think about, he's an essayist, and who they engage as an essayist. Mm-hmm. They do have some balance in the Wall Street Journal, but not as much as in other art magazines or newspapers. And this is a deliberate choice of giving him this much press. This is not a widely held view in the financial world, unless someone else wants to contradict me about this. We should go back to a gold standard.
Mm-hmm. So,
all that having, as I said, I have no opinion on the matter.
No, the point was just about the quote unquote what's sound money.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I'm also have no economic credentials, but I make just a couple of points. And
therefore, you have the right to say certain things, of course.
I think that there are some interesting ideas that relate to this, and that is there is a danger in being linked to a commodity, because the commodity's availability can fluctuate. And the example that I hope I'm not misquoting is what happened in Spain after the discovery of gold in the New World. And it was ruinous for Spain. It led to hyperinflation and essentially an economy that completely fell apart. So it would be nice if gold were a real standard, but in fact, it's a commodity, like other commodities, and therefore it has independent of its value as the storehouse of wealth, it has another life.
Right, it's a commodity.
And as a result, it's not so easy to have it in some sort of platonic universe that isn't itself subject to the market. And I think that is a major issue. So I think that what he's saying in here, though, isn't, my view of this is not that it's going off the gold standard that's created the problem. It's the failure of governments to act responsibly, because the loss of trust is a reflection of people's perception of the government's ability to live within its means, whatever that means, and to have its affairs in order. Because the key question is whether or not there will be trust in the dollar, which means will people really believe that their, you know, the treasury notes,
right,
that bonds that they,
right,
buy, will, that something is behind it. So I think the gold standard is, in my view, a straw man,
mm-hmm,
that is a substitute for what the real issue, mm-hmm, is, whether or not the government is or is not capable of continuing to convey trust. And he quotes Wriston in here, who said, instead of a gold standard, we're going to have an information standard.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning the whole world gets, and especially this world, every morning, the whole, or 24 hours a day, I should say, the whole world gets to vote on every currency at the speed of an electron.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, has been the major difference in the modern world. In fact, I think it's the major reason why, with the exception of countries that have natural resources that allow them not to need access to the credit markets, we have tremendous political conservatism that we didn't have before. Because if you can't gain access to people's trust around the world for your currency, you simply have no ability to do capital improvements.
Mm-hmm.
So, I, as I say, I don't know enough to comment on the arguments for or against the gold standard, but in my view, we're back to the central issue of trust, which I think brings us back to the Talmud.
Which is exactly the Talmud's issue.
Because that's
correct.
You know, at what point you can still convey.
And when you don't have trust, it's a case of ana'ah, in effect. So ana'ah really is the key issue here. I agree entirely. In a way, if he's having a conference, he talks about the history of money. Doesn't go back as far as this literature.
Does he?
Oh, yeah. I wonder whether he knows about this Talmudic background to this.
I'll tell James to call you, so you can give him the background, so he will add more references to this conference.
Okay.
Put him on your show.
That would be very good. Put him on a show. That's right. I got a show, right? Very good. Okay. Excellent. I want to begin this evening on Daf Nun Bet Amud Bet, skipping a little bit. This is 52B1. Now, my basic plan is to ideally get us as far as the next, I'm going to actually skip to Mishnayot. And what happens in this chapter is that once we get into the subject of tithing, that dominates a great deal of the discussion, although I'd like to do a little of that. I don't want to spend too much time with that. So I've skipped a very short amount to bring us to 52B1, and I'm on the left-hand side of the page, in the middle of the page, where it says the Gemara continues to comment on the Baraita cited on 52A. This you'll hopefully remember as soon as it's recited. Amamar, the master said, remember when a coin has been worn down to a certain point so that its value really is now the value of another coin. At a certain point, we take it out of circulation. And you remember what we do with it. It says that you're hanging around your neck. A man gives it to his wife or to his son to hang around their necks. So it becomes a piece of jewelry at that point. Okay? So that's what is being quoted here. Yikavena v'yitlena. You make a hole in it and you hang it, but savar beno o betzar savar bito. And a man will hang it on the neck of his son or his daughter. Now the Gemara says the following. Uramini. Question is asked. Uramini always means that we're now going to take another source, which is a similar time frame to the source that we've just dealt with. That is to say, we've dealt with the Baraita. Amamar means that this is a discussion among the Amoraim. Okay? So the Amoraim are now going to look at that Baraita, and they'll bring another Baraita, and they will see a contradiction between the two. And of course, one of the things that Amoraim do is to figure out how there could be a contradiction between Baraitot. It's got to be explained some way if they find it. So Uramini, the following objection was brought. Lo ya'asena mishkal ben mishkalotav. This is now the case of that coin that has lost its value, and we've got to do something with it. So interestingly, there are limits put on what you can do with it. Lo yasena mishkal ben mishkalotav. This eroded coin should not be made into a weight among his weights. Velo yizrakena ben hagrotot. Nor should he throw it among his pile of fragments of silver utensils. Velo yikvena v'yitlena betzavar benov u'betzavar bito. And he should not hang it on the neck of his son or the neck of his daughter. What? We just read that you should hang it. So here's a baraita that clearly contradicts the baraita that we had already read. Ella, what is the alternative? O yishchok, you have to grind it down. Because you can always do that with metals. You could, in theory, grind it down and you could start all over again. O yitoch, melt it down. O yakots, or you cut it up. Those are simply ways of recycling things. O yolich leyam hamelech, or you throw it into the Dead Sea. In other words, get rid of it. Get rid of it. It'll just decompose the whole thing. So that's in the Talmud, one of the ways to get rid of something, and it's a euphemism for getting rid of it, is to throw it into the Dead Sea.
So we need to do some theological digging.
You better believe it. Unfortunately, that may come sooner rather than later. The Dead Sea, every time I go down to the Dead Sea, it's less of a sea. So the chance that you can walk around on it is just all too great. Okay, so the point being here, though, what we just read contradicts the prior Baraita. Amar Rabbi Elazar says, V'amre la Rafuna Amar Rabbi Elazar. So Rabbi Elazar says, or there are those who say that Rav Huna said that Rav Elazar said, Lo kasha. That's a very common way to resolve the problem, which is to say, first of all, Lo kasha, it's not a problem. What appeared to us to be a problem, it's not a problem. Not a problem. It just looks like a problem. Kan the emsa, kan minatzad. When we say you make a hole in it, if you make a hole in the center, it's okay. But if you make a hole in the side, that's a problem. Because if you make a hole in the side, you can always file it down. So the problem is where you make the hole. And the reason that you have two baraitot here is one is talking about the hole made on the side, on the periphery of the item, which is not permanent and therefore keeps the thing again in circulation. So you just, if it already has that kind of a hole in it, just got to get rid of the whole thing. Got to get rid of it. But if we're talking about, in fact, a hole in the center of the item, that's very obvious. There's nothing you can do about that. You can't get rid of that. You can't file that down. and therefore that's okay. Therefore, there's no contradiction. It's just talking about two different circumstances. And the methodology is interesting here, where you have two baraitot. Again, the assumption of the Amoraim will be that they do not contradict one another. And there are a variety of ways to solve these things. Either they're talking about two different things. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that there are two different opinions. And we just didn't know Rabbi so-and-so said this and Rabbi so-and-so said that, and there were two different opinions. If we've explored and we saw that it ended up the same rabbi said two opposite things, then we'd have another way to solve it. It would be that there was a textual problem. There was a problem in the transmission of the tradition. But it's interesting to know that that's usually not the first. We saw one of those a few weeks ago. We saw a textual problem where the rabbi said, no, this is a mistake in the text. That's rare. Usually, this is a much more common way to explain a contradiction. Usually it is that they're talking about two different situations. Okay? Questions or comments here? Okay, we go on. Now we go back to the Mishnah. Remember the Mishnah said, Ad matai mutai lachsir. If you have a coin that is not worth the face value of the coin, you've paid something for it, there's a time limit given for the person who has received the coin to claim that, to make a claim against you. Okay? And we read that. And here it's repeated, I believe, Ad matai mutai lachsir, how long do you have to return the defective coin? Bakrachim ad she'yareh la'shulchani. In cities, until you can show it to a money changer. Bakafarim ad aravei shabbatot. And in small towns, until Friday afternoon. Okay, and the Gemara says, Maishna besele de maflig, u maishna betalit de la maflig. Why is the case of coinage such that there is a different standard than the case of movable objects? Now remember, talit, we saw that last week. A talit means a garment. A garment is the standard symbol of the movable object. Okay? So here they're using the code language. In the movable objects, we saw that there were certain time limits, but there were relatively short time limits. Right? Movable objects, remember what that was? Until you show it to another, somebody else who knows. Okay? To somebody else. So it was a relatively short time limit. And we saw, because there was a machloket, Rabbi Tarfon had a different perspective on that, that the time limits were relatively short. Relatively short, and that was something that was favored by the storekeepers. So, Maishna besela de maflig, Maishna betalit de la maflig. I would actually translate maflig a little bit different. Maflig, to make bigger, to extend. Why do you extend a larger amount of time with money? And why don't you extend a large amount of time with things? Amar Rabbaye, Kitnana mimatnitim betalit bakrachin tenan. Abaye says, what we learned in the Mishnah concerning movable objects also refers to large cities. So he said there is a difference. Abaye is saying there is a difference between large cities and small places, and it just didn't tell us that. It just neglected to give us that detail in the Mishnah. Now, because we see it in relation to money, we know it also applies in relation to movable objects. Okay, that's what Abaye says. Rava Amar, but Rava says, that's not at all true. Because if it meant it, it would have said it. And it didn't say it. So instead, there must be a logical difference. Some substantial difference of substance between these two different situations. Talit kol inish kim lebegava. A cloak, a piece of clothing, something that's a movable object. which people are transferring all the time. Any person is knowledgeable about it. In other words, you don't need experts for this. All kinds of people know how much objects are worth. You know, all you have to do is go on eBay. Everybody, people talk about these things. People talk about how much they paid for something. And therefore, as far as a movable object goes, as far as the talit, the cloak goes, it's not hard because everybody's an expert in those things. And it's easy to find. Therefore, the time is relatively limited. Okay? Cave and the love called Inish, Osela, cave and the love called Inish, Kim Libagava, Elishulchani. But as far as money is concerned, the subtleties of whether a particular coin really has its actual value or not, that's something that most people don't know anything about. People just don't know about that. They're not experts in that. They can't look at a coin and make those kinds of judgments. And therefore, Hilkach Bakrachim De'ika Shulchani, in a city where in fact you have money changers, Anshiara LeShulchani. There's an expert. The expert is called a money changer. And therefore, the amount of time is extended till you have the opportunity to show it to the money changer. Bakafarim, but in villages, the lake of Shulchani, where you don't have money changers, Adar veShabbatot, the Salkin leShuka. You wait until Erev Shabbos, when people go to the market. And then to the extent that you have any degree of expertise, in fact, you know whether the money will be accepted just by whether the merchants will know more than other people. Right? They're not real experts, but they're as expert as it gets in the small town because the merchants don't want to be caught with bad coins. Right? I saw it again today. I went someplace and gave somebody a dollar bill and out came the pen and they went over with a pen on it. So apparently all kinds of merchants are very suspicious about the, you know, fake stuff that's floating around. I was amazed. I figured that they do that for a $50 bill, $100 bill, maybe a $20 bill. That was a $1 bill. $1 bill. So, you know, and what do I know about this? I don't know anything.
Must have been your face.
That's the reason.
I really.
Well, it's encouraging. At least the dollar bill was worth more than the ink.
Right. It's a good sign. It's a good sign.
Did they accept?
They accepted it. My dollar was a good dollar. My dollar was a good dollar.
So May was a mark for disposal or something.
I don't know. But I meant the point is simply that the merchants do have a greater level of concern about these things than just dumb people, regular people do. And even though they're not real experts, in a small town, they're as expert as it gets. That's why, in fact, there's a difference between the one Mishnah and the first Mishnah and the second Mishnah. Because there really is a difference in the reality. And Abaye's contention that they're both really talking about the same thing, Abaye is simply wrong. These are just two different realities. The reality of movable objects is different from the reality of coins. Yes?
And the mere fact that the city is a far larger place with a larger market possibility in a village is the basic difference, I believe.
Well, sure. But, I mean, it also affects who goes there. And the fact that here the issue was that you have a money changer. Money changers just don't operate in small places. Right?
There's an implication here that you really, when the man received a coin in payment for something that he sold, he's checking out its value. That merchant accepts the coin, you're off the hook. Now he's got to see whether he can pay his supply.
Well, that's true. It's a little bit of a seller beware. A little bit of that.
It's not. The implication is maybe it's not so easy when there is an issue with a, you know, try to get somebody to pass it on to the next guy.
I think it's an issue of expertise. It's just a question of who the experts are.
Because it says he went to the Shuka, I guess, as a market.
Because they're merchants, and the merchants have relative expertise. I think that's really the issue. Okay? Good? Okay, we go on. The Gemara now takes the next part of that Mishnah. The Imaya Makira Afilu Yachash Neim Asar Chodesh. If he recognized it, then even after 12 months, he should accept it back from him. Hecha. To what is the Mishnah referring? Where are we talking about? I Bakarachim. If we're talking about big cities, Ha'amat Ad She'era L'Shulchani. Didn't it say, talking about big cities, that you have a certain amount of time until you can show it to the money changer? Right? Ibakafarim. What was the alternative? The alternative was that we were talking about the villages, the small places. Ha'amad ad arve shabato. There, as far as the small places go, we learn teler of Shabbos when you're doing your shopping, and the merchants will accept it or they won't accept it. So why are you suddenly telling me you have a year? You just told me you have a relatively short amount of time, either to go to the money changer or in a small place to go somewhere else, to go to the shuk. So that's a good question. When we read it, I'm sure that was the first thing one thinks about. What are they adding? What's different about this? They already told us the time limits, and now they're telling us a year. It can't work together. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Chisda, Midat Chasidut Shanu Kam. What the Mishnah is telling us is a way that people will respond out of unusual piety. Unusual piety. That is to say, even though you're supposed to do it in a certain way, there may be certain things that you should do even if you're not required to do it. So even if you have a time limit on the return of a coin, still, maybe you should still be willing to accept it anyway.
That's why Bloomingdale's went out of business.
That's why Bloomingdale's...
Because they kept taking things back regardless of the amount of time you held them. I mean, for all stores...
So, but L.L. Bean, that's when you buy from L.L. Bean, they say they'll take it back 10 years later, and L.L. Bean's doing okay. No? Tana? Really? Last time I was there, it looked good. Yeah, but you're correct. You're absolutely right. But you can see the temptation on the part of the retailer to do it. And it seems like a way of being a nice guy, too. And if you're a nice guy, what?
It's great for business. It's extraordinary to buy something.
And inflation.
Well, you've heard two different points of view. So, the Gemara sees this as an issue of chassidut, of piety. Okay? We'll say chassidut means piety. Chassidut, in other words, to be a really nice guy. What?
Only if he recognizes.
Yeah, if he recognizes, sure. Ihachi, the Gemara then says, if so, ema seifa. If you say that this is a case of piety, well, look at the end of the Mishnah. The end of the Mishnah says, Ein lo alav ela taromet. He has nothing against him but a complaint. But this is about piety. Why are you complaining? You know, what is the issue of a complaint here if the subject is about a certain way of really being nice? Liman, so the Gemara explains, who are we talking about? Who is the Mishnah referring to? ilechasid, if you say to the pious person, lo kabuli likpale mine, let him not accept the coin from the recipient. Velotar omativele, and he won't have any complaint against him. If you're saying that the guy's such a nice guy, and that he should do what he does, and you know, and he won't have anything to complain about, well, surely if you're not, you know, if you don't do anything, you have nothing to complain about. So why would a pious person complain in the first place? If he's pious, you know, if he's trying to be a nice guy, he should just be a nice guy. There's nothing to complain about. So the whole fact that the Mishnah concludes this with saying, and you only have an issue of complaint, well, that doesn't make any sense in terms of the person who's really trying to be a nice guy. Would never have a complaint. So must be talking about that or somebody else, right? Got to go further. Lo taramitivele ele lahaech tekiblamine. But if you say that it refers rather to the person from whom he accepted the defective coin, to the wrong person, this too doesn't make any sense. Ulevar de makablamine, for after the pious person accepts the coin back from him, tarome tevele, you mean to say he can have a claim, a complaint? The wrong has been rectified. He's done what you wanted him to do, so what are you going to complain about? So we don't know what the Mishnah is talking about. Hachi kamar. So the Gemara says, this is what it means. This is what the Mishnah is talking about. Indeed, a pious person will accept a coin back after the deadline, even though he is under no obligation to do so. Ha acher. But the Mishnah is not talking about the pious person, but about the other person. Not the person who's the nice guy, but the other guy. Even though he does not accept it back from the recipient, the recipient has nothing against him but a complaint. In other words, if you try to do something nice and you accept something and you're mad about it, well, who do you have to blame? Yourself. So in other words, you have whatever the situation is here, if you do accept something back, you only have yourself to worry about, and you have no complaint against anybody else because you didn't have to do it in the first place. So if you're going out of your way to be nice, if you're accepting your merchandise back and you lose, who are you going to blame? You're going to blame yourself. So ain't a love taromed, he has nobody to complain about except himself. So in other words, it's not bad to be a nice guy, but if you're going to be a nice guy, you have to accept the consequences of it. And that's true. Yeah, it's probably
not
true.
We were talking about the reverse. The not generous person says, too long, I don't have to take the coin back, and I'm not going to take the coin back.
And then the other person...
The guy who's too late is stuck.
And all he has against
you, the ungenerous person.
Well, that's the way I always understood the Mishnah. that was the way I always understood the Mishnah. So this is a slightly different angle on it. Okay. Very good. We keep going. Okay. The Mishnah goes on. V'notna l'maser sheni de'eino choshesh. He may use a coin that is worn, a worn coin, for ma'aser sheni, the eino choshesh, and we need not worry, she'eino ela nefesh ra'ah, for it is only one of ungenerous disposition who refuses to take such a coin. Now, let's talk about ma'aser sheni. Maser Sheni is the second tithe. The subject of the second tithe is discussed in two places in the Bible. In Deuteronomy 14, and this is the one that we are most familiar with, simply because it's read on the festivals. On the second day of festivals, we read from Parshat Re'eh. And therefore, it's something that occasionally, I usually say a few words about it in the sanctuary. And I say something to the effect of what the farmer has to do is that he has to turn it into coins, and then he's got to go spend his money in Jerusalem. And you have to go to the King David Hotel, and you have to have a very nice meal, and you invite all your friends, and it's good for the economy. It's very good for the city of Jerusalem, okay? And then I usually go off to say, you know, well, that's what you should be thinking about. You know, we don't have a second tithe, but we should be spending our money there and going to do that. Yes?
Could I ask one point, because I'm getting a little bit confused. I wasn't here for some time. But
well, that will be a source of confusion. You've got to keep that in mind. Yes?
But the article that you read from the Wall Street Journal, I was led to believe that the Mishnah, or the Talmud, argued that the coin was based upon its value as a commodity, as gold, this type of thing. Now, what I'm understanding that you're reading now is that the value of the money is not based upon the commodity, but it's based upon the trust of the people that are exchanging the money. And at that time, gold coins were struck with irregular sizes, but at a fixed amount of weight.
Correct. Now, the issue here...
This evaluation of money is based upon the trust of the merchant and the opinion of people, very much like the dollar and all the monetary systems in the world today. So that seems to be a contradiction to me.
The subject of the Mishnah is that, yes, there is a more or less accepted value for the metal itself. Problem is that once it's in the form of a coin, the metal wears away. And it's not obvious, necessarily, except to somebody who knows whether the dollar, let's say, is a dollar's worth of silver. That's the problem we're discussing here. If it is not, then there is a certain point at which a transaction that has taken place with that coin that doesn't have a sufficient amount of the silver in it, or the gold, whatever it is, that transaction becomes cancelable.
That is still valid.
It becomes a cancelable value. At a certain point, the transaction doesn't exist because the person who has, in this case it would be the seller who has accepted the coin, the seller has lost out. Now there are certain parameters where we don't cancel the sale, but at a certain point there is a cancellation of the sale because somebody has been wronged. And we're trying to set certain limits on that because the reality is you can't say that every coin is worth exactly the same amount.
Sure.
But at a certain point, the amount of metal in the coin is such that, in fact, you're no longer dealing with effectively the same coin, even though it looks the same.
But the argument does not state the conditions under which you would validate the coin.
Well, that's what we were reading about, the conditions under which usually have to do with the presence of somebody who knows about this, which is why we brought in the expert.
Would it be weighed? Yeah.
Yes, a money changer weighs it. So, but that's not the only reality. The reality is, in certain circumstances, merchants are more expert at this than the common man is. And so, when we don't have the money changer, we have to take the word of the expert. He, of course, may have scales as well. So it may be that that's his practice.
May or may not. It's a trust.
But, okay. Now, in Deuteronomy 14, beginning in the 22nd verse, you shall set aside every year a tenth part of the yield of your sowing that is brought from the field. you shall consume the tithes of your new grain and wine and oil, and the firstlings of your herds and flocks, in the presence of the Lord your God, in the place where he shall choose to establish his name, so that you may learn to revere the Lord your God forever. Okay? So we see here that there is a tithe. The tithe comes from the produce as well as the flock, and that you are told that you are to consume it in the place which is the place of the presence of the Lord your God, in the place he will choose to establish his name. Well, that is understood, of course, eventually to refer to Jerusalem. But here it's sort of setting up a possibility of it. Jerusalem has not yet been chosen as that place. But here in Deuteronomy, the assumption is that there will be such a place. So that is Jerusalem. Okay? Now, it goes on. Should the distance be too great for you? Should you be unable to transport them because the place where the Lord your God has chosen to establish his name is far from you? And because the Lord your God has blessed you, you may convert them into money. Wrap up the money and take it with you to the place that the Lord your God has chosen. And spend the money on anything you want, cattle, sheep, wine, or other intoxicant, or anything you may desire. Intoxicant means beer. Beer. And you shall feast there in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice with your household. Okay? So this is the law of the second tithe, because it goes on and says, but do not neglect the Levite in your community. The Levite, of course, gets the first tithe. So this is not talking about the same thing. There are, in fact, two tithes taken. One is the Levite's tithe. He has no hereditary portion, as you have. Every third year you shall bring out the full tithe of your yield of that year, but leave it within your settlements. Then the Levite who has no hereditary... Now we're going to talk about the third year is a tithe for the poor person. So that same amount that in year one and two we had to bring to Jerusalem in year three becomes the property of the poor. Okay, because the Levite is the symbol of the poor person because he has no holdings of land. Okay, so that's the system that we have. That's the system that we have. And in order to get to Jerusalem, which may be quite a distance, it may be impossible to bring these things with you. Therefore, it's very likely that in most circumstances, people went not with trucks full of food, but they went with pockets full of money. It's a much more convenient thing to do. However, there is a downside to all of this, and that downside is referred to in Leviticus 27. So we were just in Deuteronomy 14. Leviticus 27 is the very end of the book of Leviticus. Okay, the very end of the book of Leviticus. It refers to a variety of different tithes, and finally it concludes the following. The Chol Ma'asara Aretz, all tithes from the land. Here Rashi says, Zot Omeret, Ma'aser Sheni. We're talking here not really about all tithes, but all tithes that are Ma'aser Sheni. Because we're not talking about the first tithe that goes to the Levite. Rather, we're talking about the second tithe. Whether seed from the ground or fruit from the tree are the Lord's, they are holy to the Lord. If anyone wishes to redeem any of his tithes, he must add 1/5 to them. Ah, this becomes the penalty. So in other words, if you take your produce and you turn it into money, there's a 20% penalty for that. 20% penalty, okay? Well, for whatever it is, it's obviously to discourage that, I guess, or to make sure that you have yet more stuff that you'll buy. Or it could be also Well, no, I'm just going to say what I'm going to say is not. Because realize when you get to Jerusalem, there's a very good chance that purchasing food in Jerusalem is going to be more expensive than it was in the Galilee, because there's less supply and more demand. Okay? So that's one of the built-in issues here. One of the built-in issues is also involves the difference of prices in Jerusalem when compared to other places. You know, some things just don't change. Plus the fact that you have this penalty that's levied on whatever you will cash in. Okay? So that is the biblical source now, and keep that in mind. So when you have, you're going to take this money then, the problem is partially a problem of what happens with the money that you get. Right? When you take your money, or when you're going to get your money, and you have coins, to what extent do we have to be concerned with those coins, that perhaps those coins will be worn down coins? And realize there's a special problem here, because who are you doing business with ultimately? With God. That's the problem. That's the real problem here. When you're doing business with people, you know, there's one level of accountability. Here you're doing business with God, and one should assume that there's probably a higher level of accountability. And yet, what the Mishnah is saying is exactly the opposite of that. In fact, we say that when you do transfer these things to coins, the Mishnah is saying, let's quote it. V'notna l'maaser sheni ve'eino choshesh. So we're saying when you're dealing with the money that is your money that you're taking in place of the second tithe, Eino Hoshesh, we don't worry about it. She'eino ela nefesh ra'ah. Because if you would worry about it, it would be a sort of a stinginess. Well, the truth is that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense because we're really worried about God. And if we're saying you don't have to worry about God, how is that a matter of one of an ungenerous disposition? Are we saying that God doesn't have a generous disposition? It's not really clear. Okay? Okay, so we go on. Amarav Papa. Yes?
I'm a little confused. When you tithe goes to whom?
Well, it depends on what tithe we're talking about. If we're talking about the first tithe.
Let's say the first. No, not the first tithe. Yeah, the first tithe.
Okay, the first tithe goes to the Levite.
Yeah, and then...
Then there's a second tithe then, and that goes to you, but you have to spend it in Jerusalem.
Right, but what about to the poor? That's only every third year?
As far as the tithe goes, that goes to the poor. That's not the only thing the poor get. As far as the tithe goes, that's only every third year, correct. So it's year three and year six.
Right.
Remember year seven, everything goes to the everything goes to the poor.
Benefit Jerusalem? Anybody in Jerusalem? Everyone in Jerusalem?
Both to benefit Jerusalem. You heard what it said here. Let me just... It's not only to benefit. The reason we go to Jerusalem is not only because the Torah, or we want to benefit the merchants of Jerusalem. There's an independent value to going to Jerusalem. Okay? That's the reason for the tithe to begin with. To make sure that everybody goes to Jerusalem. That everybody goes to Jerusalem and does what is proper in Jerusalem, namely celebrating in Jerusalem. There is a side benefit to that.
We are talking about where the money goes and that it should be the right amount of money. So I'm just kind of trying to figure out what the charity aspect of it from...
Oh, well, it's very good what you said here, because when we're talking about the nefesh ra'ah, there's a very good chance what we are referring to here is the merchant in Jerusalem. Okay? The merchant in Jerusalem can be a stickler for coins, or he could not be a stickler for coins. Right? The merchant in Jerusalem can say, no, I won't accept your coins. But we're accepting as a general principle that merchants in Jerusalem wouldn't do that, because that would be an unseemly thing to do. Okay?
I thought it referred to the person to whom he sold his produce. Let's say in Galilee, saying he's bringing the money down to Jerusalem. So the point is, don't make yourself nuts over this.
Oh, that's very good. You're right. No, that's also correct. That's also another way to see it. That when you sell, you're getting money. Okay? And we could say, therefore, that you, as the one who is getting the coins, wouldn't accept the coins if they don't look like they're good, hard coins. Okay? If they look like they've been worn down.
Well, because if God, in effect, is your client, if he would just drive yourself nuts worrying about what.
Exactly. Exactly. So here again, the other possibility here is that, no, people who are taking their coins won't do that. The flip side of that is what happens when you get to Jerusalem. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, but I mean, it's interesting that we have this provision, because it could be just go to Mecca, go to Jerusalem. But here we have this, if you're too far away, you can have an intermediate thing, you can substitute this, it can be, it can take the place of it, which is just an interesting proviso.
Yeah, very practical. It's a very practical thing to do.
Where were the coins struck? Because
coins could have been struck in a variety of places. At different times, the coins were struck in different places in effect.
So
these are largely, although not necessarily, in the Talmudic period, they were largely Roman coins.
So
Roman coins were not struck in Rome.
If Jerusalem charged 20% more on the coins, that could be a sign of mistrust of the coin being struck someplace else, and maybe an alloy.
No, but even if it were perfectly.
There was no standard.
Well, there's got to be a standard. We're going to have a standard.
But the coins, people are bringing coins.
Well,
from every
no, they're
place.
Not necessarily, because also we're reading the Bible. In the Bible, you're dealing with a certain reality of coins. Can't. Sure.
There are coins at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. The Bible is talking about there is. There are all.
Perfect example.
Always have been coins. Always have been coins. As long as, you know, certainly from the biblical period on, coins were one of the ways that things were dealt with.
Oh, no, that I'm not arguing. I'm just saying that from different parts of the area.
Whatever it is, whatever it is, you've got to have a certain sense. We're dealing with the need to have a common sense that the coins are worthwhile.
Right.
And generally it has to do with their weight, no matter what they are. It's a much later period of time that, let's say, the coin is known or either partially or principally from the what's minted on it, you know, the certain picture on it, which identifies
right.
it as something. But that's a different thing. That's adding another layer to what makes a coin. Here, the coin basically is something that's a value. It's a weighed value of a certain commodity that's generally accepted. Okay?
You can see that manifested in all the painting, where the scales, small scales,
yep.
are such an integral part of society. They were for gems, jewels, and gold.
Absolutely.
And nuggets.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
I'm assuming in the post-temple period, maybe I'm wrong, that people no longer brought their maaser to Jerusalem. And at the time that the mission
That's
was
correct.
Already written down,
correct.
this practice had ceased to exist.
Correct. So but that makes no difference.
So much
and I was going to say, how about you? I mean, for us, whether this is really practical is irrelevant.
I don't mean for us.
For them too.
Oh, yeah.
They're in exactly the same position. For them, it makes no difference. It's absolutely no difference. The reality of these things, it's dealt with as if it is a present-day reality, even though it isn't. That's an interesting fact that you point out.
The two questions that were asked seem to show a little different understanding about what was happening than I thought, so I just want to repeat mine. The tithe is not a charity tithe. It's a tithe that one brings, that one sets it aside and then brings it to Jerusalem and consumes it there oneself, or one converts it into coin before one goes to Jerusalem. And the coin that, when you convert it, you're actually using your own, the normal situation is you're using your own coin, you're not selling the produce first. So Jay, when you asked the question...
Yeah, that's true. Jay's question presupposed it was a sale. And that's not necessarily the case. I'm not really sure whether I think in most cases it was not sold. It was simply taking your own coin. So that
makes sense, because if you were selling it, then somebody would be giving you a bad coin and you would have a case against the person who gave you a bad coin. And there was no discussion of that, so it made me...
That's why I thought that Hoshish was in there.
The situation makes more sense when you're bringing your own, because then you have no case against anybody gave it to you. Just so the whole thing, the Torah thing that you read, the 27:31, that's like a Torahic fence. It's to make sure that when you get to Jerusalem, you're not, in effect, diminishing the amount of produce that you're consuming.
Well, that's what the Gemara is going to now discuss, because if, in fact, the potential problem here is that if your money is not such good money, then in fact you may get to Jerusalem and be able to buy less than you sold. And the question is whether that's a problem. It could be a problem.
But wasn't that all the money changers were near the temple? Are those the money changers?
Well, that's a New Testament thing, so I can't exactly tell you what the New Testament was referring to. But one of the things, I don't know the language, the Greek, that's used there. Because when you go to Jerusalem today, for example, in the Southern Wall excavations, you can see exactly, there's a street, and there were purchases made of animals. Animals were made as korbanot. However, that's not money changing. That's sales. So I've always wondered to myself, again, I think it's a language, I'd like to know what the language is, the Greek that's used, because frequently one will find in New Testament things that it's simply not accurate. So I just don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
We've gone down that way for a very long time. You better believe it. And I always assumed that along that stretch were not only sales, but a moneylender or two.
Oh, well, that's very likely. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised. Yes.
The main purpose of the money changers was obviously to change the local currencies into Roman currencies.
Probably, but I'm still not sure of that. I don't know that we really know that. We may extrapolate that from our experience, but I'm really not sure, because in their currencies, in the different currencies that they had, I'm not sure that they had the notion of exchanging currencies, partly because currencies were somewhat similarly valued.
That was gold and gold.
They're all gold.
So
I mean,
it looked different.
Yeah,
so
but it was gold because the value was
they're
gold.
They're evaluating one coin that looks one way and another
it could be. Different. It could be. The Talmud, you don't get that sense, though, because the Talmud seems to talk about certain coins and certain values of coins as if they were universally recognized. Okay, and the problem then comes to be, if you can't recognize it, you can't recognize the diminishment, let's say, of the size of it. But it's not as if they're talking about, well, there was this coin and we had to change it into that coin. You just don't see that.
They would have been minted in all different places, probably. It's going to make them look, make them a little
all different.
Correct. Okay. Amara Papa, Shmamina. Okay, learn from this, from the Mishnah that we've just quoted. Hai mandamuki mazuze. Whoever is stubborn about taking coins that have a problem, mikre nefesh ra'a. That person is called a bad soul, as it were. Okay. Vahani milihu desagilahu. And this is so, provided that the coins circulate. You know, that's to say that they work, but they're really not such good coins. Nesaya lelechizkiyah. And the Gemara goes and says, well, this concept then helps us. It seems to support the point of view of Chizkiyah. The Amar Chizkiyah. Now look, let's look and see what Chizkiyah says. Ba leforta. If someone comes to change a sella, right, into smaller coins. Now, this may be what the money changer was doing. It was simply to, you know, if you were going from the Galilee to Jerusalem, you probably wanted coins that were as large, you know, as valuable as possible per the weight. Simply because it meant you had to carry fewer coins with you. Otherwise, it's burdensome. If you have to carry them all in pennies, that's a pain in the neck.
Yeah, but it's the same weight to put it into a stella. So from weight point of view, it's all the same.
Yeah,
but it's just how you handle it.
Correct, it's volume. The volume is different. The volume is different.
And the noise that it will make.
Yeah, it's a penny.
But for weight, it will be the same.
You are probably right. I assume that that's probably right. I think it's right. Okay. Hi, mandamuke mazuzi mikre. Sorry, misai lele chizkia de amar chizkia balaforta. Someone comes to change this seller, and let's say the seller is not such a good seller. Right? It's a seller that's worn down. Porta bishovya. He changes it at its actual worth. Oh, and that is to say, in Jerusalem, okay, you get to Jerusalem, the guy in Jerusalem is going to change it into smaller coins. And it's not such a good seller that you're asking him to change. He's going to actually change it according to its real worth. Balachalala, if he comes to deconsecrate Maser Sheni onto it, Michalala Biafa. He deconsecrates onto it at its face value as though it were a good seller coin. So in the Galilee, when we deconsecrated our produce, we got a seller. And we got a seller as if it were a good seller. When it comes to buy food with that seller in Jerusalem, the guy is not going to give us that. Instead, he's going to give us what it's actually worth. That's what Chizkiyah says. So that's a little bit different now. My Kamar, what is he saying? What's he getting at here? Hachi Kamar. This is what he's saying. Af al pi keshabala forta porta bishovya. Even though upon coming to change a deficient sella, one changes it according to its actual worth, namely in Jerusalem, you actually get the real value of the coin. It's in the sugar system. Did it also this morning. It was doing the same thing.
Sunday night, the whole building, the building was going to come apart.
And it's going to freeze. We're going to freeze out now.
Anyway.
Okay, let's try to go back. My Kamar, Achi Kamar, this is what it says. even though when it comes to changing it, one changes it according to its actual worth in Jerusalem, keshehu mechalala, when he deconsecrates his produce, mechalala biyafa, he deconsecrates it at its face value as if it were a good coin. So that's potentially, we would have thought that would be a problem. That would be a problem. Because he's going to end up getting less money for it. By getting less money for it, he's going to be able to buy less produce for it in Jerusalem. And of course, then he really won't be doing what he was supposed to do in the first place, which is that he was supposed to take all of his stuff and celebrate it with it in Jerusalem. Shall we say that since Chizkiah says one may use a deficient coin at its full value, he holds the mezalzalin and the maser sheni? In fact, what we are doing is we are treating maser sheni lightly. We're treating it lightly. How? Va'amar Chizkiah maser sheni she'ein bo shaveh pruta. Chizkiah, we also know from another source that says maser sheni, which is not worth the amount of a pruta, omer hu the chumsho, he says it together with its fifth, mechulal al ma'ot arishonot, are deconsecrated onto the earlier consecration money. That's to say, a guy has deconsecrated a certain amount of money. That's called lechalel. Lechalel, to deconsecrate the money. Okay? That means he's got produce. He can't do anything with that produce. He can't eat it. He can't sell the produce. He has to deconsecrate the produce. That is to say, that produce is consecrated produce. In a way, God owns that produce. Or at least, he has no control over what he does with that produce. He has to follow what the Torah says about that produce. Right? Deconsecrating it means when he turns it into money. When he turns it into money. So let's say a guy has taken $500 worth of produce and turned it into money. Right? And after that whole thing is finished, he finds 3 grapes left. He finds 3 more grapes.
He finds what, 3 what?
Grapes. He's got 3 extra grapes. He forgot to consecrate those grapes. Now, those grapes are potentially dangerous grapes. Those are very dangerous grapes because those grapes are owned by the Mikdash. They're owned by the Mikdash. And if a person treats them the wrong way, there could be severe penalties. Okay? It could be severe penalties. So we don't want a situation like that to occur. So instead, Chizkiah says that the guy can say that these 3 grapes, mechulal al ma'ot arishonot, they're included, they're deconsecrated with the first stuff I deconsecrated. Well, that would only be possible if he, in effect, overpaid the first time. Namely, if he said, well, the truth is, I don't know how much my stuff is worth. It's probably worth $490. I'll deconsecrate it for $500. I'll take $500 of my own money. So in other words, a person always errs and gives more to the temple than in fact he has to give. Because that's the way we treat these things. We always do more. Right? So Chizkiah, in other words, feels that you always have to do a lot for the temple. You can't underpay the temple, you overpay the temple. And we see that from this example, that later on, if he has a few more grapes, he can say, I include it in the other stuff. You can only include it in the other stuff if the assumption is you paid extra to begin with.
Well,
so we learn...
Cost in extra produce.
Excuse me?
Well, he has $490 worth of stuff, and or if he has $500 worth of stuff, and he'll take $490 for it.
No, he's not. Wait, he's not taking anything. He's taking his own money.
But his own money. All right, I'm back to Jay's.
No, he's not. He's not selling anything. He's taking his own money in the gallery.
He's taking it out of his working capital.
He's taking it out of his pocket.
Right, he has working capital.
Oh, so he keeps all the produce and from savings.
Exactly.
He's now doing his own
Equipment. Oh, from savings he's paying from this. From his savings.
He's a poor guy.
He's selling it to himself.
So where does the produce go?
He keeps it.
Once it's deconsecrated, he can do anything he likes with it. Because it's deconsecrated.
Once he
takes that money aside, and he goes with his money to Jerusalem, he can, in fact, at that point, sell the produce. Because the produce is no longer holy.
He's arbitraging the time when he wants to sell the produce.
Excuse me? I didn't hear.
I said he's arbitraging the time when he wants to actually sell the produce.
Okay. So then he can sell the produce. It's not until he has deconsecrated it that he can sell it. Okay?
In the meantime, the produce is still where he came from.
Okay. By deconsecrating it, he takes his own money, adds 20% to it. No, it doesn't have to come back to Jerusalem. As soon as it's turned into money.
But doesn't he have to spend the money in Jerusalem?
Yeah, he has to take that money and take it to Jerusalem. No question about that.
Can he borrow money to deconcentrate and have his money?
No.
So where's his produce at this point?
His produce is at that point in his farm in the Galilee. He's in the Galilee. He's taken money from his own resources. The minute he does that, of course, he can sell that same produce because you cannot sell consecrated produce.
Oh, he can sell it in the Galilee.
Correct.
Yeah.
Simply because he's turned it into money. The money itself then becomes consecrated. Plus, he switches the consecration of the produce to the consecration of the shkalim, of the money.
Yeah.
That money then can only be used for one purpose.
To Jerusalem.
Okay? However, once you deconsecrate Lechalel, once you Lechalel the produce, then that produce is like any other produce. And therefore, you can, the next moment, you can sell that produce. In the Galilee or wherever you want to sell it. Okay?
This farmer that had the who measure with him what is the 10% for the time. He can declare 10%, which will be only 1% of his this year's produce.
Well, this
is the definition. I mean,
that's a very strong enforcement force.
Correct. Realize
because he can say whatever he wants, and then throw out, it doesn't matter.
He can say whatever he wants. You will see in a little bit here, the punishment for saying the wrong amount is the death penalty. So it's rather strong. It's the death penalty. It's not administered by a human court, but by the divine. Okay? Punishment comes from God. And in this kind of a system, then, that's a pretty severe punishment. Okay? So there is no tax collector that's going to check it out. There's simply the divine tax collector. And you either do right or you do wrong.
Is there any social looking in?
No.
Anybody ever say that people knew that this farm did very well this year or whatever?
Well, we don't know that it is because the assumption here is that people respect the divine. If they wouldn't normally, at least they would because they're going to get punished for it. So one way or another, the divine is respected.
You know, coming back to sort of where we started, the issue of trust versus intrinsic worth, I think it's interesting to see that there's the equation of the piousness is the willingness to accept and trust and not to micro-analyze.
That's correct.
And so it is a movement away from the intrinsic toward correct.
We have seen that we have to somehow find a middle ground, because otherwise we can't have a workable system.
Exactly.
And that workable system has to involve a certain level of generosity, a certain level of specificity,
right.
But we have to find some place where it can all work.
But I just think it's interesting to then equate that with piety. As a manifestation of piety.
Correct. And I'm not sure, and we won't necessarily end up comfortable with that word, because that's not necessarily an accurate word to use in the circumstance. Because
yeah.
Remember, the word that was first used was nefesh ra'ah. Mm-hmm. It was the opposite. It's sort of being stingy, mm-hmm. in a way. And that's different from, you know, I don't know that stingy is the opposite of piety.
Right.
Those are not really two opposites. Okay? To be
continued.
To be continued.
I have one question.
Yes.
When you say worn down coin, can that, I don't know what the Hebrew is.